Leading Wall Street analyst out front on the challenges facing GE. What's wrong with one of the great corporations? Can GE be fixed? The best analysis of GE out there, and one that seems more in touch than GE's own senior management. A contrarian calling for the stock to drop 50% versus the consensus that the stock will increase 50%. Who's right? This is Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Steve Tusa is managing director at J.P. Morgan Chase, over 15 years as the senior analyst covering the electrical equipment multi-industry sector. And he's been ranked in the top three at Institutional Investors All-America Research Poll for 10 years running, and he's currently ranked number one in his sector. He's a graduate of Dickinson College, holds a chartered financial analyst designation. The over 100-page analysis he's done on GE is called General Electric Company Risk Reward Reset. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
And as I say, we've done a bunch of shows on GE. We've had Bob Wright on several times. He was, you know, Welch's right-hand man and ran NBC in a great class act. Noel Tishy, who was organizational genius, a professor at Michigan, who built Welch's model of the Croton Management Center. We did a show on GE Digital, which GE cooperated with, and I was very impressed with. So we've done a lot on this, and they've gone through some tough times. First off, the new CEO, Larry Culp, do you find that's a big plus, that he is in touch, that it is straight talk? Are you bullish on him?
Larry Culp is one of the highest quality CEOs that I've ever come into contact with. I covered Danaher for a long period of time as well. I admire their operating system. I admire most of the management team there is just absolutely fantastic. And you know that because when other companies hire these guys, generally they make it work. Just very high quality individuals. So I think Larry is absolutely if somebody's going to come through and save this company from where it was a few months ago, Larry is absolutely the guy. That doesn't necessarily mean, obviously, as per my price target, that I think the ultimate equity value of the stock is higher than where I have it at $5. So there's a big difference between coming in and doing what you have to do to get the company out of a really sticky situation and creating, you know, the kinds of value that bulls currently see in their with their price targets.
Okay, before we go sort of deep diving in a more quant way, I see you were a political science major at Dickinson. I was a poli sci major at Tufts. You put that hat a little bit on more quant side.
Yeah.
If I want to look at Immelt and Wright, Jack Welch and Flannery, right?
Sure.
Do I look and say Immelt's tenure is going to be viewed as a failure? Welch obviously looks like a success, but Bob Wright, who was close to him, told me this too, that one of Immelt's fundamental mistakes was he didn't get rid of a lot of junk that Jack bought in GE. And then finally, Flannery in action or not given enough time. Looking back, how do you assess the tenures?
Yeah, I rarely make this, I rarely make this personal about management. I truly believe, and at least in my experience, that most of these management teams do the best that they can with the situation that's in front of them. I think there are a few that can really break through challenges and turn the ship in the right direction. But part of this is the time making the man, and you really do learn that a situation is very key for a CEO to look good. And so you really want to try and come in at the bottom of a situation, you know, much like Larry is trying to do here at GE. I mean, he's getting a big pass in his first 9 months because of how bad it was. So I think, you know, the company that Jeff inherited, a $50 stock with a 40 multiple, and a very different time because Jack Welch didn't have the scrutiny and the disclosure requirements that we all have today. I mean, there's a 250-page 10-K now. They do, you know, an hour-long earnings call with, you know, dozens of slides versus literally when Jack Welch was doing this, you know, you called the company and got a five-page press release, and they could kind of tell you what they wanted to tell you. So I think I would agree that Jeff probably should have, you know, as we say, cut the cord. But, you know, back then, maybe his shareholders would have stood up and said, what are you doing dismantling GE Capital? It's an earnings machine. So I think towards the end, there were probably a few He got aggressive with capital deployment to try and cover up stuff that he probably should have been fixing internally, and kind of taking a step backwards from an earnings perspective to do that, and they wouldn't have been in the position they are today. But I'm not sure what I would have done back in 01, 02. It's a really tough situation. And I think John Flannery, similarly, being a 30-year-plus industry veteran,
yeah.
I think you really needed somebody from the outside to come in and take a cold, hard look at the facts with no ties, no nationalistic ties, if you will, to the company. So I think John did the best he could with the information that he had. Nobody really thought it was going to be, you know, as bad as it's been. Really tough go for all these guys, and I'm really not going to kind of pin these guys against the wall and hold them accountable.
Let's go through some issues here quickly then.
Sure.
Was Welch deindustrialized, diversified, Immelt reindustrialized, and focused? But in that process, the short cycle free cash flow generators, Capital and NBC, disappeared. Has that ended up looking like a fundamental strategic error?
I think GE Capital was a machine that probably should have been dismantled right after Welch left. And you just had to kind of assume the dilution. You had to tell people that this is obviously in 08, 09, the leverage they were running at GE Capital also, almost made the bankrupt, right? So that was an unsustainably leveraged machine that should have been dismantled before the crisis. So that is absolutely the right move. Now, doing it that late in the game ultimately seeing how these other businesses like oil and gas and power generation renewables played out, very tough time to kind of expose these industrial businesses to the light of day. But they are what they are. And in fact, I would argue GE Capital not only was a risk from a balance sheet perspective, it really covered up some of the shortcomings of the industrial businesses and allowed managers to probably not make the right long-term investment decisions because they could get away with more using the air cover of GE Capital and leverage and the various working capital, types of programs that they had that they're now unwinding there as well. So, I do not think that was that was absolutely what they should have been doing, perhaps 9 to 10 years earlier.
Okay.
And NBCU, there were never really any synergies with the rest of the business. And now you could argue that
a lot of cash, though.
That's fair. But when you're thinking about what type of investor is going to be, investing in GE, they were never really going to get a multiple for that. So, it's a fair point on NBC, the cash cow nature of it.
Yeah.
But just no synergies with the rest of the business. Okay. They probably could have waited and gotten a better multiple. And clearly Comcast has done a fantastic job, with the asset. But that was probably a bit of a tweener. But again, to be a multi-industry electrical equipment diversified industrial company, NBC just did not fit.
Admit. Something that I've always wondered, they monetize GEC, right?
Yep.
Capital, and they bring in all this cash. Where is all that money? it doesn't seem there's any free cash flow left.
Well, they bought back a lot of stock in trying to mitigate the dilutive impact of that transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Buying in Baker Hughes, which was, $7 billion of cash deployed that is now generating a very minimal amount of cash. As we all know, the power market has turned down, and they're now generating, probably negative cash flow this year. So it went to capital allocation initiatives that were ultimately, that's really at the end what I think the big mistake was.
Yes.
In not kind of admitting that, like, look, guys, we're going to have a balance sheet problem unless we kind of stuff some of this cash into, onto the balance sheet.
Uh-huh.
And instead they tried to kind of go for earnings, which is a classic old GE initiative,
yes.
I think that's really where I would say they it was a bridge too far at that stage of the game.
We have under a minute to go. One more long term care. I remember interviewing Bob Wright. He told me this was about to be announced. I thought it was stunning to me, and then Flannery came on board and didn't announce it right then.
Yeah,
it hasn't been handled well, has it? I don't even know what the exposure really is.
Yeah. I don't think any of us really knew what it was. I mean, we knew when we were pulling apart GE Capital that there was this other continuing operations bucket of assets that was, you know, $30 billion or whatever it was, and it was making no money, and, that's just our runoff insurance business, and, you know, it was kind of like, wait, what do you mean runoff? And it's been running off for 15 years, and so in a $500 billion GE Capital portfolio, that kind of stuff becomes rounding error, but when you pare it down to $100 billion of assets, you know, $30 billion. I'm not a math guy, but $30 billion is pretty meaningful.
We'll be right back with Steve Tusa. More on GE. Go to biztalkradio.com. Find the station closest to you. Listen over the internet. Access our archive of podcasts. 350 stations around the country. Coming right back. Back with institutional investor, top-ranked equity analyst Steve Tusa from J.P. Morgan Chase. And, of course, Jamie Dimon was at Tufts with me. Let me ask you some what I call existential questions now. They've lowered the dividend by 50%, but you've lowered your free cash flow outlook to basically zero. And then I guess it's negative $4 billion with the remaining $4 billion of dividend, if I'm correct. I don't see where and when do they get cash flow positive. And by the way, William Blair just upped their free cash flow projections for GE, if that means anything.
Yeah, I think they actually cut their dividend by 90% plus back in the fall. So they're no longer paying a dividend. The drag on free cash flow is essentially a function of not only the negative free cash flow in the industrial business this year, but the $4 billion capital contribution that they have to make to GE Capital. And if you add those together, then you're in kind of the negative $5 billion range of how they used to define industrial cash flow. Obviously, those capital contributions to GE Capital are kind of a TBD over the next several years. We think it's going to be roughly $2 billion plus over that time period. But putting that aside and just looking at industrial cash flow, this year's guidance is negative $1 billion. Next year is positive with improvement, and then it accelerates thereafter in 2021. I think we're kind of along the same trajectory as that. We actually think cash can be somewhat break-even this year, but we do not see it growing much next year. And then in 2021, which is where most investors are looking to kind of base a price target off of, we're at about $3 billion in free cash flow versus the bull case that's about $7 billion. And I think that really frames the argument between the bull case, which is $15, about 20 times free cash flow, and our $5, which is, you know, similarly, you know, a little bit less than 20 times our free cash flow number. And that's really the debate that's going on right now. What's it like in 2021?
Yeah. Well, if you read your report, it's hard to see where that money could possibly come from. And it seems like their whole strategy is this sort of like hockey stick turnaround. And
it is.
And that keeps moving out, doesn't it?
It is. And I think if one of the aspects that we've been watching pretty closely and we think the stock is ignoring is that, you know, despite the first quarter beat in free cash flow, they put up a number that was better than where consensus was. Most of the street took their numbers down for 2020 and 2021.
A second sort of existential question. Do you think the GE's fixable, or do you think it should be broken up? Your report kind of implies you can't break up GE.
I truly believe that. I mean,
why is that?
Well, first of all, if you look at just GE Capital, it's still, in our view, undercapitalized. If you split it between that insurance business we talked about earlier and then the GE Capital aviation services business, you would see that the GECAS side of the house, which includes, you know, another $10 billion or so of I would call them, you know, mixed quality assets, is levered. If you did a sum of the parts on leverage, it's levered at 12 times. And it needs to be levered at 3 times, and that's on a debt to equity basis. So that's number one. If you switch over to the industrial side of the house, sure, healthcare could go. That is not there's no real synergies between healthcare and the power and the aviation business. But power and aviation are hand in glove, and I don't even know which one is which. but the turbine technology, the metallurgy, how you make an aircraft engine and how you develop technology for a gas turbine is one of the absolute undeniable synergies. And you can read it in all of GE's marketing materials of the last 20 years, how they co-develop technologies to be able to run these things hotter and faster and ultimately get more efficiency from them that way. And so not only, you know, financially, keep in mind, right now, power is negative $4 billion in free cash generation,
right?
So that cannot stand on its own. Aviation would have to take on a dramatic amount of the balance sheet burden. But just technically, these businesses cannot be split up. And you can't sell one to the Chinese because ultimately, you know, that's giving away kind of critical technology that would probably be considered by the government to be valuable for things like defense engines and stuff like that. So I think that is the whole sum of the parts argument is very academic. I don't think this can happen in the near term.
So let me ask you, as you say that there's much more synergy under the hood than certainly I would have known. Aviation is considered hugely successful right now, although you think their cash flow is inflated.
Yeah.
And power, though, is a huge negative. But if the businesses are inextricable, should they be one P&L, or is there allocation issues, or what's the issue here?
I don't think you can have one P&L because obviously you're serving different customers, and the services streams in these businesses are incredibly important to kind of the business models. But also important to the services stream is building an installed base, and the installed base starts with, you know, guys in the lab that figure out how to take castings, apply, you know, coatings and material science technology to be able to run them at a much higher rate of efficiency. For aviation, it's about taking, you know, weight out of the engine to do that. And in power generation, it's about, you know, running it as hot as you can run it while not, you know, breaking the blade while you're doing that. And so, you know, it is at its core to build those installed bases. You're absolutely right. That is like one cost center, if you will. But to manage it as one P&L, very different customer base.
Where, to quote another existential question, where is GE growth going to come from? Now, I know GE Digital, the Predix operating software, and the Internet of Things is an $11 trillion market. Where is the growth going to come from once we get somewhere up the hockey stick and some money coming in that's free cash?
It's definitely not the Internet of Things. I mean, in my view,
really?
It's absolutely not. I mean, that on its own is not a business model. My view on the Internet of Things is, you know, I believe it's a bit of like a hybrid approach. And if you don't do it as a, you know, technology, capital goods technology provider, you're toast. So it's table stakes in my view. And you have to have a digital offering. You have to kind of understand and ultimately kind of tailor make solutions that include both the hardware and the software and the digitization. So I think all of this, you know, is part of now an embedded part of all these R&D budgets of the best companies that I cover, and I don't think GE is going to be any different longer term. They're going to take their installed base, and I think it's a smart thing to develop software solutions, Internet of Things solutions on your installed base. But ultimately, that's not necessarily captive unless you kind of build the right technologies and maintain that installed base from a growth perspective. So, and also, I mean, if you do move into that kind of business model, think about IBM, right? I mean, IBM talks about all the initiatives that they have, and ultimately they struggle to grow because the good stuff, you know, grows and the old stuff fades. And that's always kind of the trick that you're playing here when, you know, when you're operating initially what is a hardware capital goods business. It's very tricky. So I think the growth is going to come from the growth in the industries, and I don't think it's going to be overwhelmingly positive growth. I don't see long-term growth in heavy-duty gas turbines. I actually don't see as much growth as people think in GE's installed base in aircraft engines, and they have a brand-new competitor in the geared turbofan at Pratt & Whitney, which ultimately longer-term could take some market share. So I think the growth is going to be relatively pedestrian over time, and that's obviously, you know, part of the negative thesis.
Okay, we'll look at milestones in the GE turnaround strategy in our third segment with Steve. So stay with us. Institutional investor, top-ranked equity analyst at J.P. Morgan Chase, Steve Tusa. He is an expert on GE and is kind of a lone contrarian right now to the degree to which he is. I want to look at some of these things. I guess let's do the turnaround in the power business. Underinvestment, backlog shrinking, the service margins are going in the wrong direction from reading your report. $6.5 billion of free cash flow burn over the next 4 years, $8 billion fully allocated. Well, when's that turning around? What is the turnaround?
Great question. First of all, you start with an industry here that, the centralized power generation industry and heavy-duty gas turbines, the entire business model is, in flux given the dramatic drop in the levelized cost of energy for renewables. And as renewables take off, they're taking, if you will, market share, if you will, from the centralized kind of power generation sources. And that is like heavy-duty gas turbines. That's something that is a secular trend. This is a pretty significant technology disruption, if you will. And so you're really looking at an industry that is pretty stagnant for a long period of time at the current kind of level of demand in the marketplace. And as notable, the Chinese are developing a gas turbine to come to market at some stage over the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And Saldo in Italy has their turbine, and Mitsubishi Heavy has, we believe a better turbine technologically. And so this is an industry with significantly lower than expected demand, but where supply is actually at risk of increasing. And so I think that you can get through over the next several years some of the very poorly written contracts that these guys executed in the last several years when they were just trying to defend their market share.
Let me ask you a question about that right now.
Yeah,
their
sure.
Their compensation plans are profit-driven. Aren't a lot of these contracts, because I was told by an insider, they're also not getting paid by a lot of countries on this stuff, and or they're way behind. The incentives were not free cash flow driven, right? They were to bring in profits now, and at the expense of cash losses, even.
Yeah, I mean, but the problem is you have a $90 billion backlog, and the business generates revenues of $20 billion a year. So I guess four and a half years down the road, you'll have eaten through that bad behavior. But in the meantime, lots can happen. So
you don't think all that backlog's bad, though, right? Because that's like booked-in business in a sense, right? Isn't it good?
Well, it all depends on what kind of pricing and what kind of risk.
Yeah, okay. So in other words, they front-loaded a lot of bad sales.
Yeah, what I think people don't understand about this turbine business that the people get wrong is that this is not necessarily about, going into the plants and, doing better at building a turbine. Mm-hmm. These long cycle businesses are made or broken in the lab and then ultimately in the contracts you sign and the types of risk mitigation you have in these once in a decade product introduction cycles.
Wow. Wow.
And if you get that wrong, these are billions and billions of, these are billion-dollar mistakes plus over an extended period of time. It does not turn fast. That's the problem here.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. Inherently, it doesn't sound like you can deleverage when you've got negative free cash flow unless you monetize everything out of the business, right?
Which they're doing. Yep.
Is that right? So when is the deleveraging balance sheet going to be fixed?
I mean, when is the balance sheet going to be fixed? I think that they can... depending on how you define leverage, I mean, for their targets, which the ratings agencies seem to be on board with, they sell bioprocess here. They've got, Baker Hughes to sell.
Yep.
And they will be within their targets. However, even when they're there, they will be on a gross debt basis, close to 4x debt to EBITDA, which is well beyond, most of my companies. Now, they'll have $15 billion of cash on the balance sheet, but this is a company that has had cash management problems, and the ratings agencies want them to have that much cash on the balance sheet. And here's the other risk that I think people are completely ignoring is that they have their balance sheet is very levered to interest rates when it comes to the insurance liabilities and then their $25 billion pension plan. And
they're playing around with discount rates, aren't they?
So, I mean, I, I'm not going to use the term playing around. Okay. I mean, if it's fine with the auditors, it's fine, with me.
Okay.
But I do think that marking, you can say, if I mark those to market in a scenario, here is what the risk is. And, we've calculated in our report that in a recession, if the Fed cuts rates by 150 basis points, that is an extra $20 billion plus addition to those liabilities. It is a big deal if we go into recession and asset values go down and rates go down with them. It's going to be a problem.
And that hasn't really been taken in the bull case or in generally looking at in whatever GE is talking about publicly. Let me ask you this. It looks to me like they're underinvesting in R&D and the kinds of investment that a company like GE you'd expect would do. You've got the problems at Capital. You've got the long-term care problem. You've got the, as you call it, the entitlement. They're running an entitlement program that's $127 billion. That's almost $40 billion unfunded. How much capital do you think that they would need to fix all of those things, including getting R&D where it should be? How much money would that be?
Well, I don't think R&D is a capital problem. I think R&D is more of an EBITDA. You're trying to lock down the EBITDA and the cash in the near term, and you just don't really have a lot of money that you can sweep and spend. And I do believe they are underinvesting in power. It's a tough market, so I can kind of understand that. I think they're probably investing sufficiently at aviation, and they're probably investing sufficiently in renewables and healthcare.
Okay.
But I think it's a good question. How much capital do they need? I mean,
yes.
For example, they just contributed last year $6 billion to their pension plan, $6 billion. With the recent move in interest rate, if you marked their pension plan to market, mm-hmm. every 25 basis points is $2 billion. I mean, 75 basis points basically just wiped out that entire pension contribution.
Wow.
So I really, when you ask me how much do you need, I think it would have to be a pretty big amount to put everything to bed, because ultimately, when you do something like that, you want to do it once and then move on. So I don't think it's a ridiculous number. We've said somewhere in the $10 to $15 billion range historically, but I'd have to kind of see the situation, the macro situation we're going to have.
All right, so $10 to $15 billion, right? But what about the fact that the pension or the entitlement programs in whole are already like $30 billion underfunded, right?
Yeah, I don't, right.
You're just assuming that that's going to stay.
That's right. I mean, that is the right number. But that underfunding status right now,
yes.
is included to today's underfunded status. For pension is included in the debt calculation. So when you think about them being at 2.5 times and the ratings agency's comfortable, that is already embedded there.
So the risk, in other words, is if there's a recession.
Yes. And obviously raising capital in a recession is, I guess a lot of companies do it, but it's not, I don't think that's like the ideal time to do that.
Have their spread on credit default swaps widened?
It's come in nicely. It widened dramatically last fall, and then as GE Bioprocess came across, it's tightened pretty dramatically. And I think there's a lot of sell side bulls out there who have talked about that as like being the number one factor in their thesis. And I think CDS are, an interesting indicator when things are kind of going haywire. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying from a liquidity perspective, GE is in a lot of trouble here. As I've said before, this is not bankruptcy or buy. You can still have a $5 stock and not have the company, going into a liquidity situation. So, the CDS are telling you, They're pretty comfortable. This is not a liquidity situation today. But in a recession, maybe that changes. These guys will still be relatively leveraged.
Do you aviation is essentially subsidizing the corporation, right?
And
if they monetize healthcare, do they give up whatever remaining good free cash flow business they have?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I think that they're selling GE Bioprocess instead of, spinning healthcare, because ultimately they need the cash from healthcare. And so this accomplishes what you were trying to accomplish with the spin of that, asset in its entirety. But again, it's not a silver bullet, and it gives you a little bit more cash as a buffer, you know, over the next couple of years, which I'm sure the ratings agencies wanted to see. So I do believe that ultimately healthcare will be will go at some point. I just don't know if they can, like, do it today.
Yeah, I know you said before you don't see the synergies there like the other businesses.
Definitely
but
not.
But isn't it more of a growth business than what power looks like for the next 5 years at least?
Well, I mean, I think power is obviously, in my view, you know, has been disrupted from a technology perspective. The imaging business that is left over at GE is not high growth. It's a low single-digit growth business.
Okay, geez. All right, we've got our final national segment coming right up. An expert from Wall Street on General Electric, Steve Tusa. Okay, we've been through the this real bear case, as you call it. What is the upside if everything goes well? And I always say a company that's got 50% services component of their revenue, that should normally be a good, nice, recurring, annuity-based deal. Is there an upside?
I think if power kind of works its way through the issues, they chew through this negative backlog. You know, I can see my way to a free cash flow number that's, you know, maybe in the $4 to $5 billion range in 2021, or, you know, somewhere in kind of the 55-cent range. But I'm really not willing to give that more than 20 times. So I think right now you're actually kind of close to where an upside case could be. I think that's why I call it like a very negative risk reward. I just don't think that there's a, there's a chance for these guys to kind of, you know, really generate almost a full Honeywell of free cash flow, if you will, in 2021 from a standing start. So
do you think Larry Culp understands this?
I think Larry Culp understands the severity of the situation. I do think he understands. I think it's very tough for one guy to come in, though, to a situation with almost 300,000 employees, the culture being, what it is.
Yes.
And quite frankly, there's two things about this business. I mean, he never had to deal with these turbo machinery type businesses, these long cycle businesses where you book these backlogs that you mentioned a services business provides a nice annuity over time.
Yep.
But if you misprice that services business and you overpromise on that services business, that is a liability, not an annuity. And that is something that I think is very hard to kind of bank on and count on, because these businesses are very different than anything Larry ever dealt with at Danaher.
Does GE's always prided itself on its management talent? Is the management talent still there to execute this?
I believe that the management talent at GE over time, it was very strong in that, you give some of these guys a mandate, they are going to execute to that mandate. The problem is if you kind of loosen the reins on that a little bit and it starts just being about the mandate, and you have the kinds of pockets to pull from and make things look like they've been executed on when they haven't, that drive to execute can absolutely backfire over the long term. And I think that there is, there's a certain mentality that becomes pervasive that can be very counterproductive when you say, hey, hit your mandate or you're gone. And I think that's ultimately, so talented people, but I think ultimately a little bit, misguided with the wrong incentives.
Okay, which is a big deal, by the way.
It is.
At GE, the complaints were from folks like you, too complex, too obtuse, it wasn't transparent enough. Is it better now? Do you need more? And has GE gone from not manageable to not enough free cash flow levers?
I think it's all about the dollars and cents here, and I would say I haven't seen any change really in the way, in the kind of complexity of the message. Now, they're trying to give as much detail as possible, but a lot of the detail they're giving is, is way less than straightforward, and that is probably not something I would have said and would have judged 6 months ago. But I think after seeing this thing play out for the last 6 months so far this year, I would say that I've been reasonably disappointed.
Is that purposeful, that lack of straightforwardness, or they don't they're not underneath the business enough?
I don't know. I'm not,
because purposeful is suicidal, as we all know, right? The market always figures it out, in other words.
I don't know. I just know that there have been a few items that were not straightforward, and I've been disappointed by that. So I don't know whether it's on purpose or not. Paris Air Show, for example, they had 2 years ago they had 57 slides. This year they had 33 slides, and they had a cash flow chart that, you know, was supposed to show that they have good conversion and a high quality EBITDA. And when you pick apart kind of the way they presented it, it was there were a lot of numbers in there that were adjusted, and I don't think painting the full picture. So I'm not going to go down that route, okay. But I would say that I've been disappointed so far.
I hear you. And in the report, over the last 15 years, the top five executives there have been paid nearly $1 billion. To me, that's a lot of money to destroy a lot of value that's been happening. So I'll ask you this. J.P. Morgan Chase does a lot of business with GE. Are you under any pressure from the bank or from GE indirectly on what you write?
I have never, ever once felt. Now, have I been nervous about the call, as any of us would be, about being right on a big stage or wrong on a big stage? I have never once felt like I have to look behind my back and felt any pressure from what I consider to be the best bank management on the planet. They get it. And I think, it's obviously, I feel bad that it has to be kind of probably managed at a high level with the clients. I think one of the great things about JP Morgan is that they kind of understand what everybody's job and everybody's role is. And as long as you are doing it in a professional way and you've done your work and you present your arguments and there's no major factual inaccuracies, they let you do your job. And, I've been at JP Morgan for 21 years. I've loved every minute of it, and my boss's boss's boss have done nothing but, look, call it as you see it, and that's all I've done my entire career.
That's a great credit to J.P. Morgan, and I guess you're not saying behind the scenes GE's not calling people up there saying, get this guy out of here.
No, I don't know what happens behind the scenes. I'm sure that over the years, I mean, it's just as a lot of management teams would do, they'd find some issue with a report, and they would, call up. But I have never felt at all worried or threatened.
No, so, it looks like the way you do your work, you call it like you see it. So if GE starts getting it right, you'll be out there saying that. As we finish up, are you very pessimistic?
Am I very pessimistic? No, I wouldn't call myself an optimist or a pessimist. I'd call myself probably a bit of a skeptic, and I'm just calling it as I see it. And my price target that shows 50% downside is, where my math takes me. So that's where I am.
Follow the numbers. That report, General Electric Company, Risk Reward Reset. Are common folks like us able to see that report? How is it accessible or not?
I'm pretty sure if you're a client of J.P. Morgan, you get our research for a very low price. So come on down to a branch and sign up, and you can get the report for free.
Okay. This is one of the great analyses I've ever read. I wish that they were doing a better job over there, but you're calling it like I see it. And Steve, you gave us a whole hour. Really appreciate that. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Steve Tusa. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody on the next edition of Business Talk with Jim Campbell.